Thank you very much, Brian. Thank you very much, conference. I've got to say, I'm delighted to be here. I'm actually very flattered to be here also. I was at the conference last year down in Brownlow House in Lurgan. Izzy Giles invited me along. And I arrived a wee bit late because I've got two wee fellas that play football on a Saturday morning and I had to get them their matches. So I arrived a wee bit late, but I arrived just in time into the big lobby outside Brownlow House and the doors burst open, you know, and Julianne came tumbling out and William Ennis came out and they were hugging each other and there was lots of other young people hugging each other and there were tears. It was very emotional. I thought, geez, what the hell's going on? And William came over and he sort of said, he says, we've just, it's now party policy that we support equality in marriage. So it was a privilege to be there to see that. And I said, I'm delighted to be there then, delighted to be here now. I want to say something about the ceasefires to start with, and then I want to move on a little bit and talk a little bit also about the kind of legacy of that and what's come subsequently. Because it seems to me that without doubt, when you look at the ceasefires, they came both as a relief to Northern Ireland, but they also came as a moment of opportunity. They held out the possibility that ordinary people could become engaged in an open and frank dialogue with each other, where previously they might have been put off politics because of a sense of fear and intimidation in the political sphere. And it also held out the possibility that Northern Ireland could imagine itself to have a democratic, a representative democracy, at the centre of which would be equality and social justice and human rights. And with those things at the centre of it, there wouldn't be any need to return to violence. There'd be no rationale for that. And the ceasefires also held out the possibility of economic renewal in Northern Ireland and the idea of a peace dividend and the sense that, you know, we would all enjoy the prosperity that would become subsequently from that there. I think now, 20 years on from the ceasefires, we're looking back and we're seeing that, you know, our politics seem to have become increasingly sterile and our political leaders are increasingly focused on a very narrow band of political issues which they're very well practiced and arguing about. As for our democracy, our own First Minister has admitted that it isn't any longer fit for purpose. And Northern Ireland entered into the global economy, not to be welcomed by a peace dividend, but just in time to be greeted by austerity and savage cuts. And I know from talking to many of you that working class unionists and loyalists are very frustrated by what has taken place perhaps over the 20 years since the ceasefire. And what I'd like to say today is that your frustration is something which in some respects is shared by other people. I'd like to talk a little bit about my own frustrations. You'll have to forgive me, you're going to have to put up with the second media studies student of the day. My research is in areas of the relationship between media and politics and culture and increasingly now the economy. And they do tend to be some of my preoccupations, but I'd like to share with you some of the things that I'm interested in at the moment and which I think are worth thinking about. Maybe you'll find interesting, maybe you'll find useful. Billy McWinney made the point earlier on there. He was saying about, you know, image is everything. And in some respects, that's what I'm referring to today. Because since the ceasefires, policymakers have been working very hard to try to transform the image and reputation of Northern Ireland. They've been trying to, if you will, rebrand Northern Ireland in a sense, of course, as a peaceful place, but also as a place which is now open for business, as a place which is now a competitive region in the global free market after decades of violent conflict and economic dependency. And this, of course, is deemed important for a place like Northern Ireland, a relatively small place, you know, in sort of entering into globalisation. It's deemed important that our image is a good one because it's a way of sort of trying to attract economic success to the place. And if you have any doubts about the importance of that relationship between image and economic success these days, if you think back to the previous Labour government, Tony Blair was very concerned about the international image of the UK when he came to office. And he set about trying to rebrand Britain as a place which was a modern economy, as a place which was a meritocratic country, as a young, enterprising country, a place that was at the very cutting edge of the knowledge economy and the creative industries and things like that. Now, I suspect people will argue, and I might agree with them actually, that in some ways the kind of New Britain or Cool Britannia that Tony Blair proposed was really a triumph of style over substance. And I mean, you can see that today. I mean, for all the talk of modernising and enterprise and Britain being a meritocracy, today we've got a government of toffs, basically. People who are privately educated, inherited their wealth, and yet have the kind of gall to preach the rest of us about a culture of dependency and about a something for nothing culture. But that's an argument for another day. Okay, and what I'm worried about is this kind of lack of substance, in a sense, is something which is beginning to happen to Northern Ireland. In some ways, some of the changes that have taken place here since the ceasefires have been a little bit too cosmetic. Millions upon millions of pounds have been spent on trying to transform Northern Ireland's image abroad, and millions of pounds in particular have been spent on trying to attract sort of new huge global media events to Northern Ireland, with the promise that these media events will raise Northern Ireland's international profile and attract inward investment and tourism. And some of the examples of this you'll be familiar with. Belfast City Council and the Northern Ireland Tourist Board spent almost £1 million on bringing the MTV European Music Awards to Belfast in 2011. And of course that was exactly the sort of event which would show off Northern Ireland to best effect to an international audience. And it's reported that the return on this investment was £22 million for the Northern Ireland economy. Not a bad return. The cost of hosting the G8 summit in Enniskillen back in 2013 was £80 million, £25 million of which went on security alone. And it was an event which was guaranteed to bring international exposure and publicity to Northern Ireland. In fact, it was said that if Northern Ireland had actually tried to buy the international publicity and exposure, it would have cost £70 million to do that. And it was predicted that Northern Ireland's economy would benefit to the tune of a further £40 million. The producers of the hit TV show Game of Thrones, which you may be familiar with, were encouraged to film the series here with a donation of just over £6 million from InvestNI. And as a result of this initial investment, we're told again that £65 million was, and I quote, pumped into the Northern Ireland economy. Since then, more money has been given to HBO, the producers of the show, and the First and Deputy First Minister have been to Hollywood in an attempt to try to attract more film producers to come to Northern Ireland and make things here. Arlene Foster, the Enterprise Minister, has just given £43 million towards investment in media production here, and while I suspect that most of that money won't go into the pockets of local producers, most of it will find its way into the hands of American corporations. But, nevertheless, we're told that this will bring £194 million into the Northern Ireland economy. And what you can see here is the thinking behind this is big media events brought here in Northern Ireland, and it attracts, you know, more money, grows the economy in that sense. Arlene Foster made this clear. She said, capturing the attention of prospective holidaymakers, and I would add inward investment, is essential to ensure Northern Ireland stands out from other destinations in order to attract new and repeat visitors. Tourism Ireland will be seeking opportunities to capitalise on the huge worldwide popularity of HBO's Game of Thrones. And indeed, the Northern Ireland Tourist Board now have a campaign which invites holidaymakers to come to Northern Ireland and discover the real world of the Game of Thrones in Northern Ireland. Now, all this public investment in events that arise, that raise Northern Ireland's international profile and are meant to improve our image, come, of course, with the promise of jobs and prosperity. You know, £194 million pumped into the economy here, £65 million pumped into the economy there, £40 million for this, £22 million for that. And, I have to ask, I don't know where these figures come from. I'm not sure where that money goes. And we have to ask questions, I think, also about the quality of jobs which are produced by this sort of public investment. And I ask those questions genuinely. And this is a lot of money we're talking about. But when you these figures just appear in the press. But there's never any explanation of the method by which those figures are arrived at, where they actually come from. And if we ask where the money goes, well, I think, you know, we have the evidence of our own eyes. We know that this money isn't reaching in to working class areas which need it, nor into areas of rural poverty either. So for me, there's a large question mark over the economic effectiveness of this rebranding of Northern Ireland which has taken place. But there is also, I think, a serious political question mark over it as well. Because I fear that Northern Ireland's future is one in which it is assumed that economic success depends upon us presenting a very pleasing image to the world around us and to those tourists and investors. It's a notion which depends upon our continuous good behaviour, good political behaviour. So no matter what provocations or injustice people here are confronted with, we will be obliged to keep our mouths shut about it. It's a future where any sort of political protest, political expression or dissent will be discouraged for fear of the damage that it will do to the region's image and reputation. And you'll recall how loyalist flag protesters were admonished for bringing the country into disrepute, you know, for presenting the place in a bad light and perhaps putting off tourists and investors. I'm reminded as a trade unionist that some of the commentators who were critical of loyalist flag protesters also criticised me and my comrades when we went on strike about public sector pay and public sector pensions, and these commentators felt that they were inconvenienced by our picket lines. So, you know, there's two things there. Now this week, we've even sort of seen the idea floated that protesters should cover the costs of policing demonstrations or parades. And, of course, this is a reaction to loyalist protests in North Belfast, where it's reported that policing has cost £12 million. But the idea of charging people for the privilege of protesting has implications beyond loyalism. At a time of staggering social and economic inequality, and in an era of persecuting austerity, that some of our elected representatives are seriously entertaining the idea that democratic protest should depend upon the ability to pay, I think simply beggars belief. We are in danger, I think, and this is the crux of my argument, we are in danger, I think, of reaching a stage where our political and our democratic process becomes utterly subservient to economics and the demands of the market. So the G8 summit rolls into town and the world's leaders come here to discuss important global issues, and the people of Northern Ireland are expected to greet and entertain them and be grateful for their patronage. But heaven forbid that local people should see this as an opportunity to hold the world's leaders to any sort of account, or to ask questions about human rights and social justice. And just in case anyone should try, a huge and threatening security apparatus is put up around Fermanagh and in Belfast to discourage demonstrators. The G8, after all, was worth £70 million of publicity to Northern Ireland, and therefore protests must be low-key or kept completely invisible so as not to besmirch the image of Northern Ireland before the world's media. It was interesting also to note that in preparation for the G8, the government spent £1 million on fake shop fronts in Fermanagh towns and villages to try to disguise abandoned and derelict commercial premises and essentially just to take the bad look of the place. Actually, over the last 6 years, the Department of Social Investment has spent £8.2 million on fake shop fronts. Nelson McCausland says that this has resulted in a significant private sector investment in the place, an increase in tourism, and he says also, and I quote, that it has enhanced shopper experience. Although I would imagine that shopper experience would be enhanced more by having shops that are actually bloody open. But what do I know? Northern Ireland got some more fake shop fronts in the run-up to the Giro d'Italia. It also got an anxious debate about whether wall murals along the route of the race should be removed in case the world's press, as they followed the racers, should catch a glimpse of a painted curbstone or a UVF or an IRA wall mural. The event, of course, was reported to have cost us £4.2 million to host, and it was expected that it would generate £2.5 million for the economy, with some £10 million worth of publicity and advertising for the region. More figures probably pulled out of some consultants. Posterior. I'm sure everybody understands the impulse to look your best in front of others, but the erection of fake shop fronts and the suggestion that wall murals be painted over just reeks of a country desperate to paper over its economic problems and whitewash its political divisions. The Environment Minister, Mark Durkin, also announced a ban on election posters along the route of the race, as if somehow, you know, Northern Ireland, a country which had come out of decades of conflict, you know, that you'd think we'd want to boast about the fact that we now have a functioning democracy, but that apparently wasn't the case. That too might have put investors off. It feels like there's a concerted effort to whitewash Northern Ireland's admittedly troublesome politics, because that's what's deemed necessary to make this place competitive in the global economy. It's a Northern Ireland where cultural expression is welcome, but only if it can turn a profit. It's a Northern Ireland in which the past has to be sanitised and packaged as a commodity for sale in the shape of heritage attractions and visitor centres, or else it gets swept away with indecent haste. That's what investors and developers seem to demand these days. A whitewashed, sanitised, depoliticised Northern Ireland in which to ply their trade. As Harcourt Developments, the company behind the redevelopment of Belfast's Titanic Quarter, proclaimed glibly, Belfast, they said, is unique among Western European cities in that more than half of the city has yet to be redeveloped, creating a pleasingly blank canvas. A pleasingly blank canvas. Northern Ireland never was, it isn't now, and I hope it never will be, a pleasingly blank canvas for anyone. Northern Ireland has a rich and complex and regrettably violent history. It's a deeply contested history with conflicting versions of the past, the present and the future. And even today there are new people arriving in Northern Ireland, new immigrants, who come along and make their mark upon the messy canvas that Northern Ireland actually is. At last year's conference, you made a mark upon that canvas for gay and lesbian rights. You know, Tina spoke earlier on and made a mark for women in a very sort of conservative and patriarchal kind of culture. It's not a pleasingly blank canvas at all. Trying to whitewash this is like painting a wall without treating the damp and mould on it. It's not long before the stains show through again. All the fresh paint, fake shop fronts and celebrity-endorsed media events will not disguise or erase Northern Ireland's profound political problems, many of which are a consequence of the very free market capitalism that our policymakers seem so anxious to please. In fact, the economic road that Northern Ireland is travelling will in all likelihood lead to greater inequality, and inequality will further undermine social cohesion. As inequality in Northern Ireland grows and austerity's grip tightens, there is a danger that already antagonistic communities, Protestant and Catholic, but black and white as well, will be left to compete with one another over dwindling low-paid jobs, scarce housing and other threatened resources. And I think that's a potentially dangerous situation to be in. I'm worried that the determination to present an investment-friendly face to the world has led to a papering over of Northern Ireland's economic and political cracks. More importantly, it has given rise to a tendency that will try to suppress political problems rather than deal with them in an open and democratic manner. 20 years ago, the ceasefires created an historic opportunity for political debate and democratic arrangements to take the place of guns and bombs in this society. 20 years later, it seems to me it is incumbent upon all of us to make sure that it is political debate, and it is the democratic process, and yes, protest also, if it's necessary, that informs decision makers and not merely the whims of the economy. Thank you very much.